This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of pediatric distal radius fractures from the pediatric section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Distal radius fractures are the most common site of pediatric forearm fractures and generally occur as a result of a fall on an outstretched hand with the wrist extended. Diagnosis is made with radiographs of the wrist. Treatment is generally close reduction and casting for the majority of fractures. Surgical intervention is indicated for significantly displaced or angulated fractures in patients approaching skeletal maturity. Now, let's get into the episode. Pediatric distal radius fractures are common, and forearm fractures in total account for approximately 40% of all pediatric long bone fractures. The distal radius and ulna are the most common site of pediatric forearm fractures. Males are more affected than females, and in fact, distal radius fractures are 2 to 3 times more common in males than in females. These injuries are most common during the metaphyseal growth spurt, and the peak incidence occurs from 10 to 12 years of age in girls and 12 to 14 years of age in boys. Pediatric distal radius fractures are the most common fracture in children under 16 years old. The mechanism of pediatric distal radius fractures is usually a fall on an outstretched hand, which is extended at the wrist, and this often occurs during sports or play. As far as remodeling, the greatest remodeling occurs closest to the physis and in the plane of wrist joint motion, and in the sagittal plane, this is flexion slash extension. Keep in mind that remodeling occurs the least for rotational deformities. Now, let's go over some relevant anatomy. Specifically, we'll talk about the distal radius physis, which contributes to 75% of the growth of the radius, and it contributes 40% of the entire upper extremity. The distal radius physis has a growth at a rate of approximately 5.25 millimeters per year. Keep in mind that metaphyseal distal radius fractures are most common, followed by physeal. Now, let's go over the classification of pediatric distal radius fractures. Specifically, we'll talk about fractures with relation to the distal physis, metaphysis fractures, diaphysis fractures, and fractures with dislocation slash other associated injuries. As far as fractures with relation to the distal physis, the Salter-Harris classification is used. Salter-Harris type 1 injuries correspond to a physeal separation. Salter-Harris type 2 injuries are fractures that traverse the physis and exits the metaphysis, which is the most common type, and remember that this type contains a Thurston-Holland fragment. Salter-Harris type 3 injuries are fractures that traverse the physis and exit the epiphysis. Salter-Harris type 4 injuries are fractures that pass through the epiphysis, physis, and metaphysis. This type also contains a Thurston-Holland fragment. And finally, a Salter-Harris type 5 injury is a crush injury to the physis. Moving on to distal metaphysis fractures, these make up 62% of all pediatric distal radius fractures. These are subdivided into complete distal radius fractures and incomplete torus slash buccal fractures. Complete distal radius fractures can be apex volar, otherwise known as Colles fractures, or apex dorsal or Smith's fractures. Incomplete torus slash buccal fractures are unicortical, non-displaced fractures. Moving on to distal radius diaphysis fractures, these make up 20% of all pediatric distal radius fractures. These can include both bone forearm fractures, an isolated radial shaft fracture, an isolated ulnar shaft fracture, plastic deformation, and greenstick fractures. Plastic deformation occurs from a deforming force over time that results in a shape change of the bone without a clear fracture line. This is thought to be due to a large number of microfractures resulting from a relatively lower force over a longer time compared to the mechanism for complete fractures. A greenstick fracture is an incomplete fracture resulting from failure on the tension or convex side. Remember that typically plastic deformation occurs along the compression side. As far as fractures with dislocation slash other associated injuries, these include injuries like Montasia fractures and Galeazzi fractures. A Montasia fracture is an ulnar shaft fracture with a radiocapitellar dislocation. A Galeazzi fracture is a radius fracture, typically the distal third, with an associated DRUJ injury, which is often dislocated. As far as the presentation of pediatric distal radius fractures, a wide range of mechanisms for children exist, which is often a fall during play or another activity onto an outstretched hand. You must always make sure to rule out child abuse when there is a mechanism or history that appears inconsistent with the injury, when there are multiple injuries, especially of different ages. Make sure to pay attention to the child's affect, as well as grip marks slash ecchymosis. Symptoms of pediatric distal radius fractures include pain, swelling, and deformity. On physical exam, gross deformity may or may not be present. You may find ecchymosis and swelling. Make sure to inspect for puncture wounds, suggesting an open fracture. And although uncommon, compartment syndrome and neurovascular injury should be evaluated for in all forearm fractures. As far as imaging for pediatric distal radius fractures, recommended views on radiographs include an AP and a lateral of the wrist, an AP and a lateral of the forearm, as well as an AP and lateral of the elbow if the patient is tender about the elbow or if there's diaphyseal fractures present. As far as findings on radiographs, in addition to the fracture, you must evaluate for associated injuries, specifically the scapholunate interval, the DRUJ or the distal radial ulnar joint, the ulnar styloid, and or elbow injuries. A CT scan may be useful to characterize the fracture if it's intraarticular. Use this sparingly in children, given concerns of increased longitudinal effects of radiation. As far as treatment for pediatric distal radius fractures, let's go over the classically acceptable angulations for close reduction in pediatric forearm radius fractures. However, this is controversial with ongoing discussion. For patients aged less than 9 years old, acceptable bayonetting is less than 1 centimeter. Acceptable angulations is 15 to 20 degrees. Acceptable malrotation is 45 degrees. And acceptable dorsal angulation is 30 degrees. Again, in patients aged less than 9 years old, acceptable bayonetting is less than 1 centimeter. Acceptable angulations for a shaft slash both bone forearm fracture is 15 to 20 degrees. Acceptable malrotation is 45 degrees. An acceptable dorsal angulation for a distal radius slash ulna fracture is 30 degrees. Keep in mind that rotational deformities do not remodel and are increasingly being considered as not acceptable. As far as patients over 9 years old, acceptable bayonetting is also less than 1 centimeter. Acceptable angulation for a shaft slash both bone fracture is 10 degrees. Acceptable malrotation is 30 degrees. An acceptable dorsal angulation for a distal radius slash ulna fracture is 20 degrees. Again, in patients over 9 years old, acceptable bayonetting is less than 1 centimeter. Acceptable angulation for a shaft slash both bone fracture is 10 degrees. Acceptable malrotation is 30 degrees. And acceptable distal radius slash ulna dorsal angulation is 20 degrees. Remember that bayonet apposition or overlapping of less than 1 centimeter does not block rotation and is acceptable in patients less than 10 years of age. General guidelines are that deformities in the plane of joint motion are more acceptable and that distal deformity, that is closer to the distal physis, are more acceptable than mid-shaft injuries. Remember that the radius and ulna function as a single rotational unit. Therefore, a final angulation of 10 degrees in the diaphysis can block 20 to 30 degrees of rotation. Management of pediatric distal radius fractures can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes immobilization in a short-arm cast for 2 to 3 weeks without reduction, or closed reduction under conscious sedation followed by casting. Immobilization in a short-arm cast for 2 to 3 weeks without reduction is indicated for unicortical or bicortical fractures with less than 10 degrees of angulation, as well as torus slash buccal fractures. Keep in mind that there is an ongoing shift towards treating buccal fractures with prefabricated removable wrist splints, no cast, and limited follow-up. As far as closed reduction under conscious sedation followed by casting, this is indicated for injuries with greater than 10 to 20 degrees of angulation, Salter-Harris 1 injuries with unacceptable alignment, as well as Salter-Harris 2 injuries with unacceptable alignment. The reduction technique is determined by the fracture pattern, but we'll talk about the technique in more detail in a moment. We just talked about the acceptable criteria for closed reduction. However, keep in mind that acceptable angulations are controversial in the orthopedic community. Acceptable angulation is defined on a case-by-case basis, depending on the age of the patient, location of the fracture, as well as type of deformity, which takes into account angulation, rotation, and bayonetting. As far as outcomes, there is a debate over short-arm casting versus long-arm casting. A good short-arm cast is measured by the proper cast index, which equals sagittal width over the coronal width, being close to 0.7 for a good cast, and this is considered equal to a long-arm cast for distal radius fractures. Conservative treatment, though, often utilizes a long-arm cast to reduce the impact of variable cast technique slash quality. Keep in mind, however, that there is no increased risk of loss of reduction with a good short arm cast versus a long arm cast. This has been a tested point on previous exams, so I'll say it again. There is no increased risk of loss of reduction with a good short arm cast versus a long arm cast. As far as the cast index, a loss of reduction is associated with a poor cast index. This has also been a tested point on past exams, so I'll say it again. Loss of reduction is associated with a poor cast index. As far as follow-up for non-operative management, all forearm fractures should have serial radiographs taken every 1 to 2 weeks initially to ensure reduction is maintained. If there is a concern for a physeal injury, you must follow the child at least until growth is seen on radiographs to confirm that there is no growth arrest. Operative options for pediatric distal radius fractures include a closed reduction and percutaneous pinning, as well as open reduction and internal fixation. The indications for closed reduction and percutaneous pinning is for unstable patterns that are unable to reduce initially or with a loss of reduction in the cast at follow-up. Other indications include Salter-Harris 1 or 2 fractures in the setting of neurovascular compromise. Keep in mind that closed reduction and percutaneous pinning reduces the need for tight casting after setting, especially with an increased concern for compartment syndrome. Other indications include fractures that are unable to be reduced in the emergency department but successfully closed reduced under anesthesia in the operating room, which may be pinned for added stability. Open reduction and internal fixation is indicated for displaced Salter-Harris 3 and 4 fractures of the distal radius physis/epiphysis, which are unable to be closed reduced. Other indications for open reduction and internal fixation include irreducible fractures, and keep in mind that often the periosteum or the pronator quadratus can block these fractures from reduction. Now let's go over some of these treatment techniques in a bit more detail. We'll talk about closed reduction, casting, and closed reduction and percutaneous pinning. With respect to closed reduction, as far as timing, avoid delayed reduction of greater than 1 week after the injury. This has been a tested point on past exams, so I'll say it again. Avoid delayed reduction of greater than 1 week after the injury. For physeal injuries, generally limit to one attempt to reduce chance of growth arrest. As far as the reduction technique, apply gentle, steady pressure for physeal reduction. For complete metaphyseal fractures, recreate the deformity to unlock the fragments, then use the periosteal sleeve to aid the reduction. Finally, keep in mind that traction can be counterproductive due to the thick periosteum. Historically, this consisted of a long arm cast for 6 to 8 weeks, with the possibility of conversion to a short arm cast after 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the type of fracture and healing response. However, you may cast for shorter periods now, that is 3 to 4 weeks, depending on the child's age and healing on imaging. Multiple high-quality studies showed that fractures of the distal third may be immobilized with a properly molded short arm cast. There are certain special cases, like a fractured distal radius with an intact ulna, where extreme ulnar deviation of the wrist helps keep the radius fracture out to length. Finally, moving on to closed reduction and percutaneous pinning, the approach avoids the dorsal sensory branch of the radial nerve, typically with a small incision. You have to make sure to maintain the closed reduction during pinning, and as far as fixation, you can use radial styloid pins and or dorsal pins. As far as radial styloid pins, usually 1 or 2 radial styloid pins are used, and entry just proximal to the physis is preferred. If stability demands a transphyseal pin, then smooth wires are utilized. For intraarticular fractures, you may pin distal to the physis transversely across the epiphysis. You may also utilize dorsal pins, especially to restore volar tilt. For DRUJ injuries or severe fractures that are unable to be stabilized with radial pins alone, pin across the ulna and the DRUJ. Some postoperative considerations after closed reduction and percutaneous pinning: make sure that these patients follow up in clinic for repeat imaging to assess healing and position. Pin removal typically is done in the clinic once callus formation is verified on the radiograph. You may consider sedation or removal of the pins in the OR for children unable to tolerate this in clinic. You must immobilize the radial ulnar joints in a long arm cast if stabilizing the DRUJ. Finally, you may supplement with an external fixator for severe injuries. Now, let's finish this review session talking about some complications. We'll talk about casting thermal injury, cast saw injury, loss of reduction, malunion, physeal arrest, ulnar carpal impaction, TFCC injuries, and neuropathy. Risk factors for casting thermal injury include a dipping water temperature that is greater than 24 degrees Celsius or 75 degrees Fahrenheit, more than 8 layers of plaster used, or fiberglass overwrapped over plaster. Another risk factor for casting thermal injury is that during cast setting, the arm is placed on a pillow, as this decreases the dissipation of heat from the exothermic reaction. A cast saw injury can occur if bivalving or univalving a cast, so you must ensure proper technique to avoid this injury. Extra caution should be done if cutting the cast while the child is sedated or under anesthesia. Make sure to cool the saw blade frequently to ensure not overheating. Loss of reduction can occur with a poor cast index, an increased initial displacement, and incomplete reduction, which are all risk factors for loss of reduction. Malunion, keep in mind, is the most common complication of a pediatric distal radius fracture. Physeal arrest is another potential complication, and this can occur from the initial injury or repeated/late reduction attempts. An isolated distal radial physeal arrest can lead to ulnocarpal impaction, TFCC injuries, and or DRUJ injury. Remember that the distal ulnar physis is the one that most often arrests. Ulnocarpal impaction can occur from continued growth of the ulna after radial arrest. And finally, as far as neuropathy, the median nerve is most commonly affected. However, this is typically uncommon in children, but you must examine for an acute carpal tunnel syndrome. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, which radiographic index has been shown to be the best predictor of failure of closed reduction and casting of pediatric distal radius fractures? And the choices are 1, padding index, 2, gap index, 3, three-point index, 4, cast index, and 5, second metacarpal radius index. The correct answer to this question is 4, cast index. So a cast index of higher than 0.8 is associated with loss of fracture reduction in the cast following closed reduction of pediatric distal radius fractures. The cast index is a ratio of the measure of the inner diameter of the cast at the fracture site on the lateral radiograph divided by the inner diameter on the anteroposterior radiograph. Application of a well-molded cast with three-point bending or appropriate interosseous mold is critical in maintaining reduction and minimizing the risk of subsequent late displacement. Kamat et al. Reviewed radiographs of 1,001 children who underwent a manipulation under anesthesia for a displaced fracture of the distal forearm and found that in patients with a cast index of less than or equal to 0.8, the displacement rate was only 5.58%. However, in patients with a cast index of greater than or equal to 0.81, the displacement rate was 26%. A high cast index was the sole factor that was significantly higher in the re-displacement group. No statistically significant difference was noted for age, sex, or surgeon seniority. McQuinn et al. Retrospectively reviewed 155 children with distal radius and forearm fractures to assess the significance of clinical and radiographic factors in redisplacement after treatment with closed reduction. They found that initial displacement of greater than 50% and inability to achieve anatomic reduction were major risk factors for redisplacement. They also noted that the cast index was the most useful measure of cast molding and radiographic predictor of failure. Moving on to the next question. An 11-year-old boy presents to fracture clinic 1 week after sustaining a displaced metaphyseal distal radius fracture that was managed with closed reduction and cast application. While the initial post-reduction radiograph shows near anatomic alignment with a well-molded cast, radiographs 1 week later showed 22 degrees of apex volar angulation and dorsal redisplacement. What is the best management at this time? And the choices are 1, accept the deformity, cast change, and follow up in 3 weeks. 2, close reduction and cast application, follow up in 1 week. 3, close reduction and percutaneous fixation. 4, close reduction and flexible intramedullary rod fixation. And 5, open reduction and internal fixation with plate and screws. The correct answer to this question is 3, close reduction and percutaneous fixation. So after failed initial treatment with closed reduction and casting, displaced distal radius/forearm fractures should be treated with repeat closed reduction. Percutaneous fixation can decrease the risk of redisplacement. Approximately 20 to 25% of distal radius metaphyseal fractures redisplace early after closed reduction and casting. Significant displacement can lead to poor functional and cosmetic outcomes. Indications for surgical fixation of distal forearm fractures in adolescents greater than 10 years old include angulation greater than 20 degrees and rotation of greater than 30 degrees. McLaughlin et al., in their prospective randomized control trial, showed that K-wire fixation and casting was superior to closed manipulation and casting for displaced distal radius fractures when comparing outcomes of loss of reduction and number of radiographs. Of the 33 patients in the manipulation under anesthesia group, 7 had to undergo a second procedure to correct recurrent displacement compared to 1 of the 35 in the K-wire group who required exploration for recovery of a migrated pin. Moving on to the next question, what is the most common fracture in children younger than 16 years old? And the choices are 1, hand phalanges, 2, femoral shaft, 3, clavicle, 4, distal radius, and 5, supracondylar. The correct answer to this question is 4, distal radius. So if you have good situational awareness and know that we're talking about pediatric distal radius fractures in this episode, you should have gotten this question correct. But just to review, distal radius fractures are the most common fracture type in children less than 16 years old. Fractures are a common occurrence in children and adolescents. Fractures of the distal radius are the most common, making up 22.7% of fractures, followed by fractures of the phalanges of the hand, making up 18.9% of fractures, and fractures of the carpal slash metacarpal region, making up 8.3% of fractures. Distal radius fractures can occur in the diaphysis, metaphysis, or epiphysis. The majority are treated with close reduction and casting. Landon reviews the epidemiology of childhood fractures, and according to his statistics, boys have a 42% risk of sustaining a fracture prior to age 16, while females have a 27% risk. Distal radius fractures were the most common, followed by hand fractures. Moving on to the next question. You are preparing to cast a child with a both bone forearm fracture in the emergency room. During cast application, all of the following are directly related to the risk of thermal injury except, and the choices are 1, layers of thickness of casting material, 2, water temperature used to dip casting material, 3, placing the limb on a pillow during the cast curing process, 4, fiberglass overwrapping of the plaster cast, and 5, type of fracture pattern. The correct answer to this question is 5, type of fracture pattern. So causes for thermal burns during cast application are multifactorial. Halansky et al. Evaluated the internal and external temperature changes that occurred during cast application on limb models. They found that excessively thick plaster, dip water temperature of greater than 24 degrees Celsius, placing the limb on a pillow during the curing process, and fiberglass overwrapping all increase the risk for thermal injury. Lavalette et al., in a similar study using a glass tube filled with water to simulate an extremity, found that if the temperature of the dip water was higher than 24 degrees Celsius, thickness of the cast was greater than 8 ply, and if the pillow was used to limit the dissipation of heat from the cast, temperatures became high enough to cause skin burns. And moving on to the final question, isolated pronation of the forearm will most likely achieve reduction of what type of fracture in a 7-year-old boy? And the choices are 1, supination injury resulting in an apex volar greenstick both bone forearm fracture, 2, pronation injury resulting in an apex dorsal greenstick both bone forearm fracture, 3, supination injury resulting in an apex dorsal greenstick both bone forearm fracture, 4, complete both bone forearm fracture with bayonet apposition of both the radius and the ulna, and 5, distal radius fracture with 25 degrees of apex dorsal angulation. The correct answer to this question is 1, supination injury resulting in an apex volar greenstick both bone forearm fracture. So Noonan et al. Discussed the anatomy, diagnosis, treatment, and outcome in pediatric forearm and distal radius fractures in their review article. With regards to reduction and casting, the authors state that greenstick forearm fractures are usually supination injuries with apex volar angulation, which can be reduced with varying degrees of forearm pronation. As a rule of thumb, most pediatric both bone fractures can be temporarily reduced by pointing the palm in the direction of the deformity. Complete both bone forearm fractures with bayonet apposition require traction to aid in the reduction, and malaligned distal radius fractures can be reduced with a combination of traction, angulation, and rotation of the palm in the direction of the angulation. That's all for this review about pediatric distal radius fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.